Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. The World Cup is underway. What's up, brother?
My head is spinning.
It's been a really, really fun start to the tournament.
As New Order sang, the world is in motion. And it's just all happening. It's been a fun start to the tournament. Someone asked me the other day, because you're covering it, at the weekend I was on ESPN, across this great nation, then I was on local ESPN, I was on CBS on Friday, and they're like, oh, is it not as enjoyable when you're covering it? And honestly, this World Cup has just been brilliant. It hasn't been a drudge at all. There's just, if anything, when someone asks me a question, there's just too much to talk about.
Also, not to downplay what we're doing here, but it's a liberal use of the term covering it. Like, if we were Jeff Carlisle on the ground and we're fending off other reporters,
we have to file copy.
Right. Like, then it can be a grind. But to ask you and I, oh, you guys, is it tough to do this while you're covering? Well, I'm just going at home. I'm going home and I'm watching the games and
you're
I'm being a fan.
Such like, a curmudgeon.
We're not really covering. No,
you're
no,
just
I'm saying
out
the opposite.
To argue with me.
But we're not really covering it, we're just consuming it like a fan. And
what are we doing?
We're telling our thoughts to other fans.
We're not
the media,
Do you realize the point?
We're fans that have microphones in front of our faces.
Which is
That's
what
great.
Most journalists are. And by the way, podcasting...
I'm not trying to
diminish... talking about it is another form of media. Okay, we're not... Like you said, we're not trying to rummage through to get Chiche's quotes and translate them and meet a deadline.
Right.
We're not doing that. I get that. But like at the same time, we are like being put on the spot by people, ask questions. We have to react. We have to do those
True.
Things, which I enjoy, which I love doing. But the hard part of doing it is not... anything that you've described is because where the hell do I start? Ronaldo's free kick.
I know.
Dries Mertens' volley.
What a beauty.
The bugs in Volgograd. Like, it's just so much. Don't diminish my grind.
There's so much to get to. All of those things among them. Mailbag, what to watch for. Hey, guess what's back? Red card and man of the match. I know how much you all missed it. I went specifically with World Cup things. I'm wondering if you did the same.
Well, I think there was major news today that I went with. And then, what was my other one? Oh, my God, did I pick it?
Well, whatever.
Oh, yeah, I did. Both are World Cup related.
Okay, before we really get into this, obviously, this is we're now in a post-ESPN world in terms of World Cup coverage.
We are.
So Fox is off and running, and I've been watching the coverage, and I'm curious for your take on something.
Ooh.
No, don't worry. This isn't...
I don't want to trash
we're not.
Anyone.
So they're set. It's like right in just like the background there. It's just like the picture of Russia. It's what everybody thinks of when they think of Russia. Just like ESPN 4 years ago with their set that overlooked.
The Seine.
Right. The beach in Rio. Just like what you envision when you think of Brazil.
Oh, yeah. And they did the same in Paris.
So I'm just curious for when the World Cup is we now know that it'll be here.
Oh, God.
So what's like the set in the U.S. that just defines... Oh, this is the United States of America.
They will be outside an In-N-Out burger.
Like, would they be like just a set overlooking like the Grand Canyon or Mount Rushmore?
Oh, my. Somebody
said it would probably be maybe like on the national lawn in front of the Washington Monument.
Floating on a barge in front of the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, that's a good one.
Getting shouted at New Yorkers on the Staten Island Ferry. Bum Wallace!
Is it like Times Square? I'm just trying to think of what is the ultimate in America where when countries around the world tune in, they're like, oh, that's the United States. I'm just so curious.
The lawn of the White House. Could you imagine?
Yeah.
Wow. That is such a great question.
I know. I've been thinking about it.
Full Americana, I still think it would be a fast food restaurant.
Like we're here live from the Magic Kingdom. I guess we'll have to see. Years from now.
Disney. That's
no, they're not going to be at Disney World. It's going to be, I would think, either somewhere in New York or D.C. is my guess. But I'm just trying to think of what is the ultimate New York backdrop. Or American backdrop.
I just thought of they're in the middle of a field in the prairie. Like, the grass is just blowing around them. Like,
yeah, Field of Dreams style.
Oh yeah,
Kevin Costner's in the background just taking BP. That is beautiful. Let's get into what's going on, not in America, but in Mother Russia, and we start with today's action. We got to. I was wondering if we got to go chronologically, but you know what? No, no, no. We start with this.
Trippier. And what a chance for Harry Kane, which he takes. There is drama for you. Kane, the captain, provides the inspiration for England.
Derek Ray on Fox Sports with the call of Harry Kane's second goal, that one in the 91st minute to give England the 2-1 win over Tunisia. Drama.
Little bunch formation on the edge of the box. They all grouped up together. Very clearly a set play that Gareth, because we don't call him Southgate anymore. They're so relaxed and humble. He's Gareth.
Right.
So Gareth had dreamt this up. They break off. And for some reason, Tunisia, who'd pretty much done everything right in the second half, decided that one of the most lethal strikers in Europe is not to be marked. Maguire gets a flick on, he's inside the 6-yard, and he snaps his neck back and just puts it inside the post.
Yep.
It's not the kind of result they traditionally get in the World Cup. If they're 1-1 that deep into a game, it's staying 1-1, or they're losing. So, is this a New England? Alexi Lalas keep banging on about, this is New England. I'm not so sure about that yet, but yeah, it definitely felt different. There was moments in the game where they moved and passed the ball in a way that was certainly not old England. It wasn't Capello's England. It wasn't Sven's England. It was fluid. It was really good. They created a ton of chances, if you want to look at the old XG.
Well,
so they were good, and yet they were bad. Like, there were still moments where you could see the old failings. Like, for example, I don't know what... Let's look at the penalty. I don't know what Kyle Walker's doing. I think it was soft, but it's still a penalty. He had no reason to raise his arm up. So then you're thinking, formationally, is that a problem in the formation? Not really. He could be a covering fullback and find himself in that position quite easily. Crazy stuff, the kind of random stuff that befalls England at tournaments. But I think the big takeaway is that they kept doing the right things, kept moving the ball, and they got the winner.
Yeah, I mean, there was a stretch of time, especially in the first half, where I felt like every time I looked up, chance, another chance, and a chance again.
The opening 15 to 20 minutes, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, between Lingard, Sterling, it's funny.
Stones.
Yeah, but Raheem Sterling, we talked about in the England preview, sure, he's great at getting himself in the right positions, but when the ball falls to him with a chance to score, does he have the finishing ability to put it home? And we saw very early those questions were raised again.
Well, the flag was up, which kind of saved him on that one. I think a flag was raised. But whatever, he completely, as Ali Wagner
tripped
over his feet, didn't know what foot to go with, was kind of a tiny little bit ahead of it, which certainly didn't help things. Yeah, those things don't... I don't think he'll ever have the tag consummate finisher, but he gets himself into such good goal scoring positions, and his pace means that he's always going to be on the end of things. And I mean, there was a big call at 1-1 for Vardy. Like, why isn't Vardy in there? And I would have tended to agree. I would have made that change to run in behind and give Tunisia something different to think about.
Yeah, it's just a performance that's a little... it's kind of hard to judge because
I think
England should be so much better than Tunisia, but just because it took an act of late drama for them to go on and win, I don't think I'm going to say that they were poor in this game.
Yeah, but they put Tunisia away 20 years ago with a really good team in good fashion in Marseille, right? And they go on and they play Romania in the next game and they're beaten. On Twitter that I'd worry for them against Belgium. Well, I think that'll be a humdinger. I think that could be like a 2-2, 3-3 draw, something like that. I think they got the 3 points. There's failings in the side, definitely. But those failings were there before the tournament. And the fact is, they didn't bottle it. And that sounds like a very unscientific term, but we've seen them do it. They didn't panic.
No, certainly not. The both Kane goals, they were such... I mean, Kane is great at he's so dynamic, he's able to score in so many different ways, but I've seen him have so many of those, just kind of lurking at the far post. Arsenal fans have seen him do it against them a couple times. So he was everything that you hoped the captain would be. First multi-goal game by an English player at a World Cup today, Harry Kane, since...
Gary Lineker, two penalties against Cameroon in 1990.
Very good. Very good indeed. You mentioned the penalty. Kyle Walker actually was asked about it after the game on Fox. Here's what he said.
In the Premier League, probably not. In the World Cup, I think, I have caught him. I've got a call from trips to leave it. So I've just tried to shield the ball and, you know, let it run across me for trips to get it. But as I say, it's a learning curve for me. You know, probably head it away next time and then think about the if I should have left it or not after.
That's a fair answer, I would say.
Yeah. In the Premier League, I don't think it's going to be called.
There were a lot of people I saw on Twitter reacting to it that were really mad that they're saying, okay, he has his arm up and a Tunisian player runs into it. How is that a penalty on Kyle Walker? I don't know if that's a totally fair representation of what happened.
No, he extends the arm to block the run. Like he said, he's trying to shield him, but shielding in the penalty box with your arm up towards his head and not his chest. I think if the arm's a bit lower, it's a different thing. But then if he goes over, he could be done for like tugging, a perceived tug at the jersey. It's no win there. I'm not even so sure. I'd need to see it again. My head is so frazzled with football. Could he even have headed it? Could he have jumped up and flicked it on?
I mean, he says he could have. I don't know.
I'm not so sure he could, because if he could, is Trippier going to call leave it? You know, Trippier probably says, maybe made the shout that that's coming to me. I don't know. There's no point over-analysing it because he's fessed up and said, look, I've called him.
And he says, I'll learn from it. It's so funny, before we move on to the other couple games from today, with England, all the talk about them, I was listening to another podcast and they're talking about England and they're saying, you know, there's something refreshing about going into this tournament. It's a podcast of other English people. And
relaxed and humble.
Right. They're saying, you know, it's not the same kind of hype. It's something nice about that maybe
they're likable.
But then they're asked, so, okay, so what do you believe will be a good result? Oh, well, I think semifinals is what we have to. Well, which one is it? Like, if you think this is a team that should go to the semifinals, then that is hype. You're saying one of the best four teams in the tournament. So it's, look, in English, ultimately, they can't change their stripes. They can tell themselves all they want, you know, oh, we're just going to relax. But if you saw some of the scenes today from London, there were, I mean, people just losing their minds. Yeah. So very quickly, they jump back on board, and they should.
Well, that's the fan culture. That's what the World Cup does to you. I don't blame the fans. What I do blame is the BBC, the Independent, the newspapers, who keep going on about how humble this team is, that they've hyped the humble. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're so likable. If you keep saying they're bloody likable, then likable becomes the hype. Relaxed, humble, likable. You know, just stop. You know?
Yeah.
They've hyped the fact that they're relaxed. This is incredible. I don't want to hear about it again.
Very buggy today.
Very buggy.
Volgograd.
Yeah, Volgograd. Ugh.
Yeah,
gross. I saw people like in our industry who were doing pieces to camera and right beforehand spraying a film in the air and then like 10 seconds before they go on air, so at least they've got a little bit of time
like
bought.
Like a quick shield. I was reading that Sky Sports was supposed to be doing media interviews with the team, I guess outside of the team hotel the day or 2 days before the game, and they had to abandon it because they were attacked by mosquitoes.
Jeff Shreves was interviewing Henderson. And Henderson had a bug mushed onto the side of his nose. So, yeah, gross.
Yeah. You mentioned Belgium before. They defeated Panama today.
They did.
3-0. I don't know if it exactly went the way that you thought.
Second half did.
Yes, right. The first half, you know, Belgium, lots of chances, but I give Panama credit. They hung tough for about as long as they could. But then what Panama and a lot of teams don't have that Belgium has is Dries Mertens, like the ability on a ball, like it seems like Panama has kind of cleared the danger. A ball's just sitting up there,
and it's dropping.
Right, and they have a play, and Belgium has Dries Mertens who can do that. A great volley, and then the second goal to me is the one where if I were a Belgium fan, I would start thinking, okay, this team could be special.
I'd be going, look at the speed of play, look how quickly we did things, that all the time.
Yeah, like the Mertens one, a great goal, you'll see it on every highlight, but it just kind of,
I mean,
just kind of happened. But Belgium, the second goal, De Bruyne makes a move, gets into the box, sharp, I mean, from the outside of the boot, sharp line drive pass right to Lukaku's head like a heat-seeking missile, bang, into the net. I mean, that's what you start thinking about when you're watching that team play.
Yeah, and look, a volley, it dropped out of the sky. It was a hacked clearance, and he's just caught it perfectly. But the build-up in the second goal, the build-up in the third goal in particular, and the finish by Lukaku is what you're looking for from this Belgian team. But they need to get out of the traps quicker. And I've been saying, I will say this about every one of the top teams or the dark horses or the what we've seen over the last weekend or so, 3 days or so. Speed of play, Andrew. Move that ball as quickly as you can against this opposition, especially the massed ranks of the defence. You're not going to hit them with a diagonal ball. They want that all day long.
Yeah. This was actually tied for Belgium's largest ever margin of victory in a World Cup match. Good for them.
Ooh. Really?
Are you saying that ESPN's stats and notes email is wrong?
Tied.
How dare you?
So it was a 3-0 win.
Today, yeah.
Right. So their last 3-0 win was against...
Well, I'm not saying it was 3-0. I'm just saying the margin of victory, a 3-goal margin of victory is tied for their largest margin of victory ever in a World
Cup. Seems modest, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of does. Lukaku also 15 goals in his last 10 games for Belgium. That's pretty impressive. Next most over that stretch was Eden Hazard with 5. So Lukaku, he's been able to successfully replicate all club form with the national team.
And I mean, he had an assist on the third goal, but prior to that, I was screaming, just get Hazard off the field. You've got enough on the bench. Get him off, rest him. He picked up that knock against Costa Rica in the friendly. Ooh.
Yeah. But
And Thorgan Hazard came in, which is important
Thorgan.
For us. Yep.
That's right. The year of the Hazard. So Belgium, they do pretty much what you would expect, 3-0. And then last but not least, Sweden and South Korea, 1-0. Sweden victorious on a game ruled somewhat by VAR.
Not a good game, let's be honest.
Right. This is Sweden's first World Cup win since 2006, but it's kind of dominated by perhaps there's been a lot of VAR usage, and I promise we're not going to bore you with too much VAR talk, but this a lot of people are saying this might have been the first VAR hiccup so far. Here's what Shaka Hislop said on ESPN FC. He was critical of the way it was used in the Korea-Sweden game.
I thought it was a clear penalty. The referee had a good position and a clear view of it, waved it away, and then in the middle of a South Korean counterattack, stopped it to review, and which I thought, well, one, he got the initial call wrong, which he shouldn't have. A referee at this level should make that call. And secondly, it was an improper use of review procedure and the protocols that have been spelled out. If something needs to be reviewed, you've got to wait for the ball to go out of play. Whether it's a Korean goal or not, you've got to wait for the ball to go out of play and then you review. To stop it in the middle of play, in the middle of a promising counterattack, means that the referee could only make one decision at that point. As it turns out, it was the right call, but all the same, it was two wrongs kind of making a right here, which I don't think does anybody any good.
I think he pretty much nailed it. I agree with all that. And he's right. You know, one of the concerns with VAR is that there's going to become this reliance on it where referees and linesmen are going to be afraid to make calls. And maybe that was what happened here because it was an obvious. Look, obvious is unfair because we get the benefit of having seen all these replays, which then kind of infects our mind a certain way. But it looked like a penalty. And Shaka's, he's kind of right. Sometimes when the penalties seem fairly obvious, they should just be called in real time rather than maybe using this reliance on the technology.
So far, VAR hasn't impinged my viewing pleasure yet.
Right, and it's been used a lot,
it
so
has,
that's saying something.
So that's good, and I've been doing a solid job of trying to not get into VAR conversations.
Yeah,
I know it's a major part of it, but you know how adamantly I oppose it or have issues with it.
I know.
So I need to move on and enjoy the games. I can't let it spoil. I just have to trust the process.
And you know what? You're a big man for saying that, and I give you a lot of credit because if you go on Twitter while these games are going on and VAR gets used, there are some people, I think Dan Thomas tweeted this, that there's just some people who are so determined to hate this. And I know you hate it, but I like the fact that you're willing to say that, you know, so far I'm okay with how it's gone. That's very good of you.
Trust the process, and I don't want to waste my life, you know, arguing with people on Twitter about VAR. There's
no,
sunsets and Chinese food to be eaten.
Yeah, the VAR conversations. It's like the new promotion relegation in the United States. It's just like
that's
exhausting.
Not going away,
it's
my friend. It's exhausting because you can't deal with it.
No. I have no problem with it. It's just I find those conversations really, really tiresome.
Yeah, because there's no end and solution
no,
in sight.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's see. We move on now. Look, like we've said throughout this tournament, we're going to be giving you podcasts at least through the group stage on Mondays and Thursdays. You know, obviously we'll focus, like we just did, on the games that happened on this day, but we don't want to just brush over the things that have happened in the time since.
Because some of them gave us such joy.
Yeah, so we've each kind of come down, and we'll do this over the next couple of weeks, with our sort of three big things that stood out to us from the first few days, or from one podcast to the next. The first one I have here is a really broad one, but it'll kind of allow us to encompass a lot of things, and that is the fact that the favorites, with the exception maybe of today with Belgium and England, but most of the favorites seem to be struggling so far in this tournament.
They are. And I think we have to reserve judgment, obviously, to the second game. In some instances, Argentina only drew with Iceland. That they can come back from that. Germany's defeat to Mexico.
Well, can we talk about that one? Maybe a little
Which
bit
one?
More. Germany and Mexico.
Okay, let's go with that one. That seems more detrimental to Germany than what happened to Argentina for me. There seems to be... They were so bad. That could easily have been 3-0. I know they came close to the end as Mexico naturally had to sit back a little bit on the 18.
And let's give Germany credit. After Lozano scored 3 minutes later, they did hit the crossbar.
They did,
free kick.
But so, it's a set piece. There wasn't a great amount of flowing attacking football. And they were very un-Germanic. And I don't want to delve into like footballing stereotypes, but they exist for a reason. You would never expect Germany to be so naive at the back that they'd leave their centre halves exposed so much, with the wing backs bombing forward and Kroos straight up the field. Khedira, no help to him whatsoever.
None. Yeah.
None. There was an interesting snapshot in the first half where Mexico get a turnover. And by the way, let's give Mexico credit. They were perfectly ready to spring this trap. Mexico get the turnover. They break down the field with Carlos Vela at pace. And you're like, oh my God,
where is everybody?
Where is everyone?
Yes, it's just, the midfield was completely empty.
It's just Boateng and Hummels running back like the Keystone Cops. And the next thing, into picture comes a huffing and puffing, completely gassed Toni Kroos, who in one sprint aged about 10 years and looked like Peter Reid chasing Maradona for that amazing goal in Mexico 86. I was like, what is going on here?
I couldn't believe... I mean, Mexico's ability to launch seemingly successful counterattacks in the first half was really a sight to behold.
And they, as Troy Deeney would tell us, had the cojones to leave three guys on the halfway line. So say, for example, Germany had a corner kick. They left three guys ready to go on the break.
Yeah.
This was kamikaze stuff from Mexico, but it absolutely worked.
Well, it's a lot of what we talked about with Mexico leading up. We were really excited about their front line. Lozano, Chicharito, Carlos Vela. I mean, we knew that there was a lot of speed there, and I've got to give a lot of credit to some of the guys who were a little deeper in the midfield.
Guardado.
And Herrera.
Herrera was magnificent.
Yes.
Magnificent. That you're dead right to give them praise, because they're getting lost in the wash a little bit because they do the water carrying, they do the hard work. But Lozano was fantastic. I thought it was absolutely crazy to take him off when they did. I know he was probably...
Halftime came at the right time. It was JP Della Camera on the call, I believe.
Yeah.
And one of the guys, either him or Tony Miola, were talking about how, you know, maybe the worst thing that could have happened for Mexico was that the half occurred. But I saw it completely differently. I felt like if that half went... Mexico were just... They were running on adrenaline. An event from the goal, eventually that wore down, and you saw Lozano. He had... At like minute 42, he was done. He couldn't make runs anymore.
If I had to be critical of one thing, though, it's the veterans up front, Vea and Chicharito. Andrew, they were so prolific. As good as they were in what they had to do, there was breakaways, one in particular, where it was comedy stuff. They were falling over their legs. The ball was getting caught between their feet. That game could have been 3-0. There's two instances in particular I'm thinking of in the second half. And when he brought on Rafa Márquez, I was like, Osorio, you're going to screw this up. Germany are going to equalise. Because obviously, Márquez is into head balls away to try and tighten things up at the back. When I actually thought, you can go and catch them on the break.
Get another.
Absolutely. Mexico were tuned to play only one way. To tinker with that at the end was high risk. And we saw a couple of chances, maybe half chances, but still chances. That volley from Julian Brandt that went flying past the post.
Hmm. Yeah. The goal that Mexico did score, here's how it sounded.
Chicharito dropped it back. Give and go. Chicharito from Guardado. Here he comes. Hernandez leads it. Lozano cutting, looking, shooting. Lozano, goal. Mexico leads.
Fox Sports again, JP on the call there. We're focusing a lot on the Mexican side of this because they really did play well, and there was nothing fluky about that result. I know Germany controlled so much of the possession, but it's one of those games, I think, where don't allow that stat to kind of poison your mind. Mexico, I thought they were deserved winners. On the German side of it, here's Rafa Honigstein on ESPN FC talking about the loss for Germany.
I thought they were quite awful, certainly in the first half. This was a Germany team that didn't turn up. And it was interesting because we were talking about this before the start of the tournament, where similar performances were seen and we're being worried about. And Löw was telling us, don't worry, come the World Cup, suddenly everything's going to be fine. In effect, those performances, those problems repeated themselves. the lack of cutting edge, the slow tempo, lots of easy balls being lost, and then a real lack of cohesion when it comes to recovering. No transition game whatsoever. 50 meters of space when they lost the ball up front, and then the back four, and suddenly sometimes only even two from the back four left by themselves to hold the fort. Plus, another thing that was really interesting, all the Germany players afterwards coming out and saying, we were totally surprised. We were briefed, I mean, they didn't say it, but they kind of hinted it. We were briefed that Mexico were going to press really high and then play possession football. But they did the opposite. They pressed very deep and then played counterattack. So they took a whole 45 minutes to get to grips with it. And in the second half, it was too late because they couldn't quite find the final ball yet again.
Whoever scouting report that was.
This is just so not German. Detail is what they're good at.
And then for them to cancel their media session and all the German newspapers just destroyed them for it, calling them, you know, all kinds of different names. One had the headline, was it Bild that had the headline, Wimps, you know, for refusing to answer the questions for what went wrong in that first game. Look, with the only thing I'm looking at right now, this tournament has the potential to really open up if somehow, well, not somehow, now it seems almost somewhat likely that Germany and Brazil face one another in the round of 16. Because we've all kind of, you know, a lot can happen, but in my head, I've kind of gone with that will be the final, and who knows what will happen before then. But well, I've always thought that, and man, so it's going to open up for someone if that winds up being a round of 16 matchup.
We're going to have to see, obviously, how they respond. It's so weird. I know it's the first game, but I mean, they can easily go on and win their respective groups. They can still do that. So I just want to see the reactions first before. It'd be kind of disappointing almost to see that game so early.
Yeah. Let's see. What else do you have?
I have the quantity of quality goals so early in the tournament. Yeah. I feel like that's a rare thing. I'd have to go back and think of other tournaments, but three brilliant Belgian goals today. The Mertens volley was a peach. You know I love a volley, especially that one, which is completely placed. Nacho for Spain. I can't tell you the feelings it gave me. I can't. It's like kissing the most beautiful girl in the world, eating the most beautiful food, like the first mouthful of a great glass of red. It was all that. Oh my God, the feelings. Ronaldo's free kick. Again, I'll talk a bit more about him in the next bit. And then Kolarov's free kick and Coutinho's goal as well. Just a glut of great goals.
Yeah, really has been. One other one for me. I don't know how deep you want to go on this. The Landon Donovan stuff.
Yeah.
First of all, I'm kind of surprised that this is so much of a thing. Like, to me, I don't know. The thought of American fans rooting for Mexico in this tournament always seemed kind of weird to me, the rivalry being what it is. And then Landon Donovan obviously taking it to a different level. Look, I'm not going to be one of those people who scolds you and tells you that, no, you should be rooting for this team and not for that team. Root for whoever you want to root for. I don't care. For me, you know, this is the rivalry of this region, the United States and Mexico. It's not – this is hard to do because politics are so intense right now between these two countries. But for me, I keep politics out of this. It's okay to hate – the Mexican soccer team and be an American fan.
Because it's a sporting rivalry. It absolutely 100% is. And Landon, when people push back at him, conflated the two.
He took it to a place that was really
wrong.
Intense, really fast. I mean, for a lot of people, this is not a...
And he apologized on Twitter today.
And he deleted the tweet when he went at Carlos Bocanegra and kind of made it into more of a political issue.
Why didn't he just say, look, guys, I'm doing it for the money, because that's what you're doing. Well,
he may not be. We don't
for God's sake.
Look, JJ, he went to play in Liga MX this past year. He clearly does. I do believe that he has some sort of affinity for the Mexican people, and that's fine.
Of course, we all should.
Do I
have Mexican friends. If I turn up wearing a U.S. jersey, they are not going to be bothered. One bit bothered about it. They understand the rivalry. They understand that it's football and rivalry. He was in the wrong for conflating it with other things. Don't do that. It's not fair.
Yeah. So root for who you want to root for, but I don't know. I just can't bring myself to do it. I mean, there's been too many huge games, too many negative results for us, too many, you know, physical battles with them kicking players all around the field.
Right. And us inflicting our own dose of zero on them, our own pain. It's a great rivalry. Foster it. Enjoy it.
By the way, they're also on my list, if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
After we saved them 4 years ago, and then they lose to Honduras to prevent us from getting into the playoff this year. So they're on my list. How would I look to go back on the list? So I can't do it. Here's Taylor Twellman talking about Landon Donovan rooting for Mexico.
It's healthy to be rivals. It's right. No problem with it. Everyone has their own price tag, apparently.
Whoa.
But I'm going to finish it with this. Because a former teammate of ours, Carlos Bocanegra, tweeted Landon Donovan. Landon went from 0 to 100 about building bridges, not barriers, about Mexican-Americans and whatnot. And yet this is the same guy that questioned German-Americans and whether or not they were passionate enough to wear the red, white, and blue. I'm confused. All I'm saying is I'm not going to root for Mexico. That's the same team that tried to literally kick our rear ends in World Cup qualifying. That's the same team that the players tried to break my leg playing. Why do I have to root for him? It's healthy.
I would say if Landon is genuinely interested in building bridges, that the fee that he gets from Wells Fargo should be given to a Mexican-American charity. How about that?
Wow.
That would make
sense.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, if he's serious, or otherwise just tell me, you know what, I want to put an old extension on the house in Cali, JJ, so I needed to do a bit of shilling for the old Mexicans.
Let's see, you have anything else before we get to the mailbag?
Yeah, I've got one left, and okay. I call this one Know Yourself, Know Your Worth, after Drake. And this stood out to me. You look at the big three, Ronaldo, Messi, Neymar, and it strikes me that Ronaldo, the marginally elder statesman, is at an absolute peace with his role in a team. While we question what's up with Messi, how does Sampaoli get the best out of him, why is Neymar dropping deep, etc., etc., Ronaldo is absolutely at home in it with his place in this Portuguese team, to the point where he is changing his free kick style. He curled that one up in the air and over the wall, Andrew, when for years he had a different style of doing it. Like, he's in the moment, he is fit, he's healthy, he knows his role. Like, we never question if he's doing too much. He definitely isn't. Is he doing too little? We don't ask those questions. When he's positioned, he's ready to go. He knows exactly what he needs to do. You can debate the three as footballers, right, and who's the best. But right now, Ronaldo knows himself, his role, and like, he's absolutely delivering. And that stood out to me. The toils of Neymar and Messi versus Ronaldo. This is a guy who's older, has won everything, and yet is at peace.
Yep. There you go. Hey, before we get to the mailbag, and Tim Vickery still to come as well, one of our favorite guys to talk South American soccer with. He's got a ton on Brazil, Argentina, Colombia. Should be a great conversation. But before all that, oh, JJ, my friend, Hims. Did you know 66% of men lose their hair by age 35?
I did know that.
Yeah. You know who looks like he's been on Hims? The new bust of Ronaldo at the airport in Portugal.
Well, Ronaldo's got a beautiful head, presidential hair. He's definitely not.
They fixed the bust, and it looks like they fed Hims to the original bust, and now we've been left with a beautiful Ronaldo bust.
You think Neymar's on Hims?
With that hair?
Yeah.
It's possible.
Yeah. It's not great.
Well, then no, I would say he's not. Because the thing is, when you start to notice hair loss, it's too late. It's easier to keep the hair that you have than to replace the hair that you've lost. So I ask you, do you want a bald spot to pop up, or do you want to do something about it first? Do you want your hairline to recede, or do you want to do something about it first? Well, here's your solution, folks. 4hims.com, a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. Thanks to science, baldness can be optional. Hims connects you with real doctors and medical-grade solutions to treat hair loss. No snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements or prescription solutions backed. These are prescription solutions backed by science, my friend. So no waiting room, no awkward doctor visits, which I hate. You save hours by going to 4hims.com. It's so easy. Just answer a few quick questions. A doctor will review it and can prescribe you. Products are shipped directly to your door. How easy. Just order now. Listeners to this podcast get a free trial month of Hims for $5 today, right now, while supplies last. See website for full details. This would cost hundreds of dollars if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy, but no, not the case here. $5 today, right now, while supplies last. Go to 4hims.com/offside. That's FORHIMS.com/offside. 4hims.com/offside.
Why didn't anyone tell Willy Caballero about Hims?
I know. It's too late.
Or tell him to be a better goalkeeper.
Oh. Wow. There's also that. Do you have a quick mailbag?
I have a very quick mailbag.
Yeah.
Leo Brother, now that the joint bid has won the 2026 World Cup, what city stadium would you like to see host the final? Obviously, the Azteca would be incredible, but I'd love to see a World Cup final played on U.S. soil. That will definitely
happen.
Well,
that's happening.
Yeah, that's definitely
and
happening.
I don't know if anything's official, but I thought MetLife Stadium was believed to be where the final's going to be.
Imagine a Jersey World Cup final.
That's what they're saying right now. Why, if not, what are you thinking? If not there, where?
Rose Bowl, Pasadena.
I mean, they did that in 94. You want to see the same one again? I don't know. I'm okay with doing something different.
What about Mile High in Denver? Nah.
That's kind of
is a bit
random.
Too random.
Yeah, I don't know.
Jerry World.
No. Ugh. Come on, Jerry Jones. Look. Ugh. What's the next one?
Cole Martin. Some people were weighing in on our Twitter last night, because I just completely don't like the idea that Argentina will be better when Messi's gone. Maybe they obviously need to find a way to, you know, bring him into the fold and use him to his full potential, but whatever. I mean, he dragged them to the final. So Cole Morton popped in with this from Opta Javier. 69%. The win percentage of Argentina in these World Cup qualifiers decreases 69% without Lionel Messi. So they were saying that I basically made the argument that they would not have qualified without Messi. I thought that was written in stone. People argued the toss with me, 69%. They're getting nowhere near Russia without him. Petey Smith, now that all the pre-tourney favourites have played their first matches, who's feeling the best? Who's feeling a little anxious going into their second match? Belgium are feeling good.
Yeah, I was going to say, how far down are we going when we talk about pre-tournament
favorites? Yeah, no, put Belgium in there. Okay. Belgium are feeling good. Argentina are not feeling great. Germany are feeling like they've got some work to do.
I mean, look, once France looks around and sees all these other sides that have drawn or lost, they won their game, so they got to at least feel good about that.
Yeah. At Fradcliffe, would there be anything more England than beating Tunisia, being overconfident to Panama and losing, than facing elimination against Belgium? No, there would not. Alex Koski, Atlanta, Georgia. I've been a listener since the original 2014 World Cup previews.
Oh my God.
And seem to remember when there used to be an ad for Irish whiskey at the end of the podcast. That's true. Please drink responsibly. Through two moves, an 18-month-old son, and being assigned Newcastle during the original Help a Fan, you guys have occupied a lot of hours in my life over the years. Thanks for another round of great previews, and cheers to enjoying the World Cup. Well, Alex, cheers to you.
That's awesome.
Thank you for being one of the OGs.
I love our listeners from the 2014 podcast.
I know, because they've seen us change and grow, yeah. I'd like to think. Finally, Matty Nips, there have been a lot of really, really nice goals so far. Four or five potential goals of the tournament. It's absolutely true. If you were picking one now, Messi's metaphorical gun to your head.
Oh, I can answer this in 2 seconds. Nacho.
Yeah,
it happened so early in the tournament, but that's going to be really hard to be topped for me.
Might be a toss-up between Nacho and Ronaldo from the same game for me. Oh, that free kick, Andrew. Up and over the wall.
Yeah.
The audacity to change his kicking style.
Look, there's been a lot of good ones, but the Nacho one, it was just like, oh my God, it was beautiful. It was picture perfect. The line drive, bang. Oh, man. All right, JJ, we continue now. And I would say over the past couple days, the question I've been asked more than any other, even more so than anything about Germany-Mexico from like friends who are casual fans, has been, so what does this mean about Brazil? Like, people are so nervous that the favorite is now in some real danger here. And I can give an answer, and that carries maybe a certain amount of gravity. But we thought for an even deeper level of gravity, we go now to one of our favorite people to talk to, Tim Vickery, who covers, of course, South American soccer for a variety of publications, ESPN FC and the BBC among them. And he's back on the show with us right now. Tim, what's up? How are you?
Nowhere else that I'd rather be. How are you all doing?
Oh, I'll tell you. I'm glad you say that. Start off on a nice, happy note, because I came into this as an American fan just not feeling the same kind of excitement this year with my country not in it. It's something I'm not really used to in terms of how old I am. And I'll tell you what, man, I have come around really, really fast on how much I'm enjoying this tournament.
Right on. My two first World Cups were the ones that England didn't qualify for, 74 and 78. And in a way, you know, I found it easier because it meant that there was none of that gut-wrenching tension of, are your team going to slip up? You could just kind of sit back and let it wash over you and enjoy it. And I loved every ball.
I've got to be honest.
I can relate to what you're going through.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you, Tim. When Ireland qualified, the rare times that they do, it's not always enjoyable as a World Cup.
No. You suffer. Being a supporter is a foolish thing, really. It's a foolish thing to do with our time. You can just to have that detached air of neutrality in a World Cup, you know, sometimes that can really make the tournament.
And I'm wondering if one of the fan bases feeling some of that right now is the Brazilian one, which is how we kind of introed into this. And Tim, I guess I want to go back kind of to that fan base specifically and go back even a little bit before this tournament started. And we saw some of the discontent between Brazil's fans and the team prior to them departing for the World Cup. Do people there feel a connection with this team?
No, I think they do. With the results over the last 2 years since the current coach took over, it's won a lot of people around. And the TV ratings towards the end of Brazil's World Cup qualification campaign, when they ended up sailing through, the TV ratings were extraordinarily high. The country itself is going through a very bad time at the moment. Well, certainly before yesterday's game, if Chichi were to stand for president this year, he'd be a shoo-in. It would be a landslide win. Although it's a little bit of a disappointment after what happened against Switzerland. Though having said that, for the first 20 minutes they were terrific. For the first 20 minutes they entirely lived up to their billing. The story really is what on earth went on for the remaining 70.
Tim, you did a piece for World Soccer, which is well worth a read, on kind of, I suppose, the tactical side of it, or the way Brazil fell so deep. Can you explain what on earth was happening?
I can't. I would love to be able to explain why that happened. It's almost as if some of them felt their responsibility had been carried out at the time that they took the lead. And I know Brazil have terrific pace on the counter-attack, and perhaps they were thinking in terms of retreating, giving the pitch to Switzerland, letting the Swiss come forward and then catching them on the break and killing off the game. But I think it was entirely the wrong thing to do. If the opposing centre-forward has no pace, why let him close to goal?
Right.
Why not keep him a long way to goal? Why bring him close to goal where he's dangerous? Secondly, if your midfield trio, your central midfield trio there, includes Felipe Coutinho and Paulinho, you don't want to be in your own half. And Coutinho isn't a genuine midfielder, really. He's not a box-to-box midfielder. He's someone who does his best work in the last 30 metres of the field, as he showed with the goal. And Paulinho, I thought, was terrific for the first 20 minutes, because when Brazil are bombing forward, he's the man who's continually getting into the box as an element of surprise. I mean, he nearly scored the first goal. But between the two penalty areas, he doesn't do a great deal. He certainly doesn't do a great deal, which is outstanding. So having these two players back deep in your own half seems to negate their own strengths. Now, what concerns me a little bit here, and in part, I think, this is first night nerves. I think experience tells you it's always unwise to judge a team by its World Cup debut. Let the tournament unfold a little bit until you reach definitive conclusions. But what does concern me is, and after the match in the press conference, the coach, he confessed that this was an error, having sat so deep. So you're thinking, well, if he knows this is an error, how was this not corrected, given the amount of time they had to correct it, even with the half-time interval? And that worries me a little bit, because Brazil are a team without a captain. The captaincy is done on a kind of rotation basis. They feel that there's not a natural captain here, so it's a different player doing it in every match, which on the one hand shares the responsibility around, but on the other, it means that you don't have a set leadership structure on the field. And sometimes I think Brazil need a set leadership structure. Maybe they need a set leadership structure to get a grip on Neymar at times when he wants to showboat. And I think they certainly needed one yesterday to try and get them higher up the field, because I think from a tactical point of view, that was a big mistake.
In terms of all this, I mean, it's interesting. We've gone through qualifying. We've gone through the World Cup tune-ups, and we're now a game in for Brazil. Do they know what their preferred 11 is yet?
I think there's the one place which there's been a lot of debate about, which is the third place in midfield. During qualification, you've got the trio. Paulinho and Casemiro have always been there. Paulinho to bomb forward, Casemiro to sit and hold. But who's the third one? During qualification, it was Renato Augusto, who knits the side together well, but is injury-prone and not particularly quick. So after qualifying, they had a look at Fernandinho in that position to give them more defensive cover. And then they played a friendly against Croatia, where the Croatians pressed them in the first half anyway, and that trio there, which was Fernandinho, Casemiro and Paulinho, couldn't play their way out. So then they went for Felipe Coutinho, and it was in the friendly against Austria a week before the World Cup that they played this magic quartet for the first time, with William, Gabriel Jesus and Neymar, plus Coutinho as a midfielder. Now that they repeated against Switzerland, and I think for 20 minutes it worked well, although it does put strain on Coutinho, because it obliges him to operate as an out-and-out midfielder. He's got to get up and down the field. And it was noticeable that it was in his sector of the field there, the Brazilian left, the Swiss right, that Switzerland were able to play their way back into the game. So exactly what happens to that one position, I think, could vary as the tournament goes on. Myself, I would also I also regret the fact that since qualification, they've made a change at centre-back. During qualification, it was Marquinhos. He's lost out to Thiago Silva after qualification. But Marquinhos is much younger and much quicker. And I think that with their quickest centre-back, it would be easier for Brazil to defend far from their goal. So maybe that's another thing which will come under the microscope. But it seems that the one position which could vary is that third position in midfield.
Tim, one more for you on Brazil before we move on to some of the other South American sides in this tournament. You referenced this a little bit in your answer a couple answers ago about the World Cup nerves with this team. And I saw Chichi, he mentioned anxiety as having played a factor in this. And I couldn't help but hear that and raise an eyebrow. It's a team, you know, littered with players who have played in Champions League finals and massive games for their clubs. What did you make of that comment, you know, where some of these guys may have been feeling anxiety coming into this game?
I think it's different when you're representing your country. There's no doubt about it, I think, these days that the Champions League, the business end of the Champions League, is of a much higher standard of football quality than the World Cup. But the power of the World Cup to make people feel represented is extraordinary. And remember, in Brazil and the World Cup are synonymous. And as far as Brazilians are concerned, historically, it's synonymous with being winners. The World Cup is a moment when Brazil appears in front of the entire planet as winners. Now, clearly, there's a huge stain on the carpet from what happened 4 years ago on home ground. And I think the players are well aware of that, even the majority who weren't on the field. You know, they're aware that the prestige of Brazilian football has been damaged. You know, in that moment when they line up for the national anthem before a game in the World Cup, there's no equivalent for this in the Champions League. That moment when they line up and the national anthem is played, they're thinking about the people that they're representing back home. And it's an extra burden. It's an extra responsibility. It's one that I think perhaps weighed on them a little bit against Switzerland.
From Brazil, Tim, we move to a country where their talisman has a metaphorical gun pointed to his head every 4 years. I think we know what Iceland do to stifle teams. Numbers behind the ball, central midfields going out, doubling up on the wings, so there's no way that there can be an isolated fullback or what have you. But what did Argentina not do, or can you kind of let us know what, I mean, again, if you want the American question, hey, what about Messi? What happened there?
Well, Argentina have been a shambles for some time. They're a team without a coherent idea of play. I mean, the obvious comparison that I would make is with Spain. You know, Spain have had all of that turmoil about sacking their coach, go behind right at the start against Portugal, go behind again on the stroke of half-time to a goalkeeping error. And with all this adversity, Spain have an idea of play to fall back upon. They know exactly what they should be doing. Argentina do not have an idea of play. They haven't for some time. They have problems in a number of positions, in the goalkeeping position, in centre-back position, in the full-back position, even, I think, these days, in central midfield as well. And over recent years, really, and Messi has carried them again and again and again. But he's not really backed up by any coherent idea. The coach, Sampaoli, he took over a year ago, and he's a coach who during his career has had one big idea, which is the furious high press. The high defensive line, throwing both fullbacks forward at the same time, looking to create two-against-one situations down the flanks. It's a very dynamic style of play. It's a very attractive style of play, but it's a very risky style of play, especially if you don't have any defensive pace. And we've seen in some of Argentina's matches over the past year that there is a question that whether his idea can work with the defensive resources available to him. Now, Sampaoli has seemed to have arrived at this conclusion. So they don't look like a Sampaoli side. They don't defend with that high line anymore. He's realised he doesn't have the defensive pace. And what really surprised me, though, I think, in the Iceland game, not a lot surprised me. Anyone who's seen Argentina over recent years knows that kind of plan A is give the ball to Messi and hope. Plan B is give the ball to Messi and hope. And there is no plan C. Well, what surprised me a little bit is that they tried to funnel everything through the middle, where Iceland were particularly strong. I was expecting more combinations down the flanks. And now it seems in training for crunch game against Croatia, He's now having a look at a back three again. Now, that's a formation that he abandoned in November when his defence collapsed against Nigeria. So at the moment, he really doesn't seem to know where he is. And we're back on page one with Argentina. Now, the World Cup is like time speeded up. And sometimes teams can suddenly click during the course of the competition. And that may happen with Argentina, although I don't think there's any real way of papering over the cracks that they have defensively. But at the moment, I think they look like an absolute shambles. I think they're in real trouble in what is a very difficult group.
Tim, that's a fearsome thought of a three at the back there. What three would it be, not to put you on the spot, and will we see Rojo and Otamendi in it?
What he's trained with in the last few hours, I think he's having a look at a few things. But he's trained with Mercado, who is a kind of mixture of a right-back and a centre-back. Otamendi to anchor the three, and the left-back, Taliafico, to play a left-sided centre-back. It is an improvisation, again, you wonder if there's enough pace there, especially as that the holder in front of him is Mascherano, who's a magnificent player. And he's still a very fine passer of the ball. But he's defensively, he's not what he was 4 years ago. Time has caught up with him a little bit. I thought, you know, over the last few years that Argentina's defence has been held together with a combination of duct tape and Mascherano. And I'm not sure Mascherano is quite capable of doing it anymore. So perhaps they need some more duct tape.
Tim, just a quick one now for you. We're on about, you know, players that are able to take someone on and beat them. I was so frustrated watching Salvio get the ball and then turn back inside into traffic, mm-hmm. or play the ball backwards. And, you know, maybe he's not as a, you know, perfect guy to take on players and beat them. But Christian Pavon, do you see him coming into the side, maybe starting? Because I know he didn't do a ton when he came into the game, but he at least looked like he was a bit more direct.
Yeah, I'd probably prefer to see him on the right, actually, than on the left. He's a little bit wrong-footed there. He has been training with Pavon in the starting lineup, with the back three. You've got two holding midfielders, you've got two wing-backs, and you've got Messi operating behind Aguero and Pavon. And so that effectively really means Pavon coming in place of Di Maria, but being able to operate more as a striker, perhaps being able to rove a little bit, which might be interesting. And it could be an idea that saves Argentina.
Tim, Colombia in action tomorrow. They were probably one of the most enjoyable sides to watch in the 2014 World Cup. You think they had that in them again in 2018?
I found them very underwhelming in all of the last 4 years. And we haven't seen a lot of them recently. And they played one low-key friendly on June the 1st, a 0-0 draw with Egypt. It looks as if they've settled on a kind of 4-3-3. There have been doubts about James Rodriguez, about his level of fitness, though I expect him to play. This time, in contrast with 4 years ago, they have the centre-forward. They have Falcao García up front. Now, that gives them a wonderful centre-box, a penalty box predator. But he's not the greatest back to goal. He has to be supplied. You've got to give him service in front of goal that he can attack. And James is a key supply line for him. I think James loves playing for Colombia because he's important. You know, that thing that he couldn't be at Real Madrid. The potential is there for Colombia. I think one problem that they had in qualification, it was a very laboured qualification campaign with few highlights, is they use too many players, and they use 45 players in 18 games, which for one coach is terrible, really, and it shows that the coach didn't really know his team or his system. I think having to focus on 23 and a starting 11 will do them the power of good. But for the moment with Colombia, it's more potential than anything else. But I think they have the potential to find themselves during the course of the campaign, and I wouldn't put another quarter-final appearance beyond them.
I saw you tweet about Osorio yesterday, Tim, and what Mexico managed to pull off against Germany. There was big talk over here amongst the Mexican soccer fraternity about the way he's tinkered with this lineup, brought in so many different formations, tried so many different things over the years. From what you saw of the game, do you think he just stumbled across it? Was this an aberration, or can we see Mexico go a bit deeper in the competition?
Well, I think he clearly only said that he planned specifically for the Germany game. Which I think was laudable. On my fear about them, he's a very interesting coach, and I like his commitment to playing a pair of wingers and a central striker. And it was terrific. It was beautifully done against Germany, especially in the first half. You know, to keep three up the field was bold, and it really paid off. And having seen his side collapse against Chile 2 years ago, in what was basically a home game for Mexico in the Copa Centenario, when Chile just walked through them. And then a year later, when they played Germany B in the Confederations Cup, Germany just walked through them again. The game was over as a spectacle in the first 10 minutes. I was fearing something similar against Germany A. But it was clear that he thought long and hard about how to protect himself against the Germans. We will see in the course of the competition whether what he does works as well against other opponents, because I think it was made to measure for the Germans. I think he spent months and months and months dwelling on the defeat to Germany B last year and anxious to avoid a repeat of that. But they certainly put a marker down. And one thing, I've never been to Mexico. I don't know it, which I badly regret. But I wonder, and this is a question that I'll throw back to you. You obviously know the Mexicans much, much better than I do. Do you think there's a possibility of them getting a bit too full of themselves after this victory?
I mean, their fans certainly, their fans are as fickle as they come. They've already started singing Osorio's name in Russia and in the streets of New York already, which wasn't the case, particularly after what happened last week. I don't know. I feel as if the Germans played so much into their hands yesterday that I'm not so sure after seeing that first of all, anybody is going to allow, or any of their next opposition is going to allow that to happen in terms of, yeah, you know, the midfielders wandering, the fullbacks wandering and exposing the centre backs. I just can't see it. I think the cat might be out of the bag a little bit, but look, they've got enough quality maybe to trouble some other teams. I'm not so sure on that one, Tim. I thought they were great, but I also noticed the breakaways, the 3v2s, things like that. I mean, if they don't take their chances consistently in the tournament when they're presented like that, I mean, Germany could easily have equalised late on there. So I still think the jury's out on Mexico for me.
All right, we'll all defer judgment then. We'll all make our predictions after the event. They're usually much more accurate that way.
Yes, good stuff, Tim. It's been a fun start to the tournament. We appreciate your time. Maybe we'll catch up again before it's over. Thanks, man.
My pleasure. Thank you. Cheers.
Our thanks to Tim. Love catching up with him. So locked in on all that stuff. The Mexico thing is interesting to me about their overconfidence. I could see that potentially being a thing.
I mean, it was such a seismic victory. If I can draw a parallel, when Ireland beat Italy in 94 in the first game, they went out and they lost actually to Mexico in the next game. And I think the emotional intensity of those games at such quick succession, they might be a bit flat in the next one. It can happen. It's not even sometimes complacency, it's just you're drained.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is that, by and large, this side has been through it together. Like, this is a team that has been around through the CONCACAF Cup win over the U.S., through the Chile loss, through the Brazil or the Germany loss in the Confederations Cup, so they kind of know what it is to not let that happen afterwards. I think, you know, you got to believe at some point they'll learn lessons. So,
but I think, like I said to Tim, I think a lot of teams have learned a lesson not to do that against Mexico. Yeah. And I'm sure Osorio is going to try and change tactics.
Quick what to watch for here, World Cup style. Group A resumes on Tuesday. The big one there, I look at Russia and Egypt, with Russia coming off that really dominant 5-0 performance over Saudi Arabia, and Egypt getting Mo Salah back. At least that's according to all reports.
To save the tournament, apparently.
I can't wait to see him. Very, very excited. Disappointed we didn't see him in that first game against Uruguay.
A little bit surprised.
Yeah. By the way, I mentioned Saudi Arabia. Glad to hear they're okay after their plane, apparently on landing, flames were seen bursting out of the side of the engine on the wing.
It was It's the video is terrifying.
Yeah. So they are okay, thankfully. Group B on Wednesday, 2 o'clock p.m., Iran and Spain. Iran with the 3 points after that dramatic victory over Morocco on the terrible own goal. You feel so bad for guys who do that in a World Cup late on like that. And Spain, of course, coming off the dramatic 3-3 draw. This is either Iran's chance to take like a stranglehold of this group or Spain's chance to take it back.
I feel like Spain will be on 4 points at the end of this one.
And Group C, Thursday, 2 o'clock, Argentina and Croatia. One interesting note on this, I don't have much on Argentina, I don't know if you do, but Croatia have sent home striker Nikola Kalinic after he refused to go on as a sub in Croatia's 2-0 win over Nigeria. So Zlatko Dalic, manager of Croatia, would rather play the rest of the tournament with 22 guys than have the AC Milan striker on his team. And you know what? I kind of respect it.
I kind of do, in a way. If what the reports are true, well, you can't act like that. What was he doing on the bench?
There's conflicting reports because Kalinic is saying that he refused to go on because he had an injury.
Why was he a listed sub?
Well, that's the thing. Dalic and the Croatian staff say, no. No one on this team was dealing with an injury. Everyone was fit to go. And if he didn't want to go on in that situation, goodbye. We don't need you.
I suppose Tim had the most interesting news on Argentina, that they're tinkering with a new formation with three at the back.
Yeah.
Which, again, what
it's
were we
very
saying?
In vogue.
What were we saying in the lead into the tournament? We hope that Sampaoli has got it right and got it sorted. And he
it's
hasn't.
Interesting what Tim was saying about Argentina. How, you know, they have Messi, and then they don't have anything beyond that. They've always lacked a style. How are we going to play like Spain? Everyone knows what Spain is going to set out to do. Usually Germany the same. Sampaoli was supposed to fix that. Like, he comes in with a clear identity.
Yeah, but the identity is something that those players can't do, which is press, 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 win the ball, turnovers, chances.
It surprises me that that group of players, there's some really talented guys on the team that I would think would be able to play like that.
When Messi gets on the ball, Andrew, the movement ahead of him is, it's like they freeze and they all defer to him.
Let's see. Bring it down the stretch.
Red card.
Oh, red card. You go first.
This is from ESPN FC, Jonathan Johnson. Deep sigh as I read this. France left back Lucas Hernandez admitted he employed some theatrics during the 2-1 World Cup win over Australia on Saturday. After an own goal from Aziz Behic gave France the lead in the 80th minute, Hernandez said he occasionally went to ground to eat up time. As we saw against Australia, there are moments where I exaggerate a bit, Hernandez said at a news conference on Sunday. It is part of the show, part of the game. I am used to doing it. It helps the team to buy some time. I do it from time to time. It is a part of me.
Would he be proud of this?
Why do you, like, it's, and it's also obvious. It goes under the heading dark arts. We all know about this stuff. What? It's a part of me. What does that even mean?
And also, it's not part of the show. Like,
no,
this
no.
is the part of the show that we all hate.
It is part of the show, part of the game.
It is part of the game.
Part of the game. Unfortunate part of the game. Not part of any show. I mean, what the?
Yeah. Also, you're France against Australia.
Come on.
You're proud that this is what you were resorting to beat Australia? You're one of the
favorites
of the tournament.
Napoleon is turning in his grave at this. Ridiculous stuff. Absolute nonsense. And by the way, fans know what you're doing. You don't need to admit it with some kind of pride.
Yeah. Let's see. My red card, I went with Sweden. Their manager, Janne Andersson, apologized yesterday for a member of his coaching staff spying on the South Korean team at a pre-tournament camp. I'm reading now from The Guardian. The Sweden manager, Andersson, offered his apology for the incident at the training camp in Austria, where a member of the Sweden coaching staff got into a closed training session and was told to leave. The Swede thought the training session was open, Andersson said, and left when asked. Quote, he watched for more of a distance as a result, Andersson said, but did not comment on allegations that the individual in question, Lars Jacobsen, had rented a house across the road from South Korea's training ground. Jacobsen was quoted as saying, it took a long car journey into the mountains to reach the house, but it was a perfect spot to observe the Korean team's training.
Oh, good Lord.
Not very covert when you're bragging about this. But how about this? Korea's manager, Shin Tae-young, was prepared for this and had his team ready for the intrusion. Here's what he said. We switched our jersey numbers around because we didn't want to show everything and to try to confuse them, he said. They might know a few of our players, but it is very difficult for Westerners to distinguish between Asians, and that's why we did it. What a thing to say. He continued, all coaches probably feel their opponents are always spying on them. I think it's perfectly natural that we all try to get as much information on each other as we can. So Shin Tae-young taking a very lighter side to this.
Spygate.
Yeah.
By the way, did the Swedish manager then finish all comments by saying, and we're on to Cleveland.
Yeah, how about that?
Caught offsides, man of the match.
All you.
Walter Barr, the last living member of the US soccer team that upset England at the 1950 World Cup, has died at age 91. This is from the Associated Press. Barr died Monday in Bowlesburg, Pennsylvania, from complications that resulted from a broken hip, according to the granddaughter Lindsay D. Barr, a film writer for the Associated Press. A midfielder who scored one goal in 19 international appearances, Barr collected a throw-in from Ed McIlvenny on June 29, 1950, in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, and took a shot from about 25 yards that Joe Gaetan's deflected past goalkeeper Bert Williams with a diving header late in the first half. The US held on for a 1-0 win, a triumph portrayed in the 2005 movie The Game of Their Lives. I say the older I get, the more famous I become, Barr told the AP in 2010. I wasn't famous for 50 years. A team of soccer unknowns, the US won the famous match against an England side that included Alf Ramsey and Tom Finney, who earned knighthoods. So that's Walter Barr, the last remaining member of that amazing team.
Yep, incredible. And obviously it would happen during a World Cup.
It's just obvious,
incredible.
Yep.
Let's see. My man of the match, I went with Fernando Hierro of Spain, now their manager. He'll be sticking with David De Gea despite a poll conducted by Marca, Spanish newspaper, asking who should be the team's keeper, David De Gea or Athletic Bilbao's Kepa Arrizabalaga. Arrizabalaga won 49% to De Gea's 41%. Hierro's response, quote, De Gea has all our confidence. He was said this at a news conference on Monday. I see him calm, training the same way as always. I have very clear ideas, and I know what path we have to follow. My experience tells me that sportsmen need to be given confidence, not just in the good times. After something like this, you need the time and space to digest it. It's not about action, reaction. They had a day off, and he was able to clear his head. We've spoken to his day-to-day coach, Jose Manuel Ochoa-Torena, and we all agree the path to follow. JJ, this was the best keeper in the world coming into this tournament. He had a bad game. There's no question about that. But after one game, you're going to abandon him?
Absolutely not.
I mean, I would think that would just like scream panic to the rest of the team. No.
Marca being very tabloidy.
Trust your guy here. Well, it's not really them.
They held a poll.
Well, they put the poll out there, but it's the people, the fans are the ones who responded and resoundingly said, no, De Gea out. We've seen enough.
Fans are so reactionary in the heat of the moment.
Well, thankfully the manager is not, because I think he's making the right decision by sticking with De Gea. So there you go. Our first World Cup podcast.
Feels good.
Yeah, since our last one back in 2014, which apparently some people still listen to us who listened back then.
And remember the adverts. I wonder in 4 years' time will people be going, I remember when you had an ad for baldness. Well, we're not advertising baldness, obviously.
No. We're trying to prevent baldness.
We are.
So this was fun. We'll be back on Thursday with another podcast looking at the past few days leading up to then. Our thanks to Tim Vickery for joining us, giving all the info about South American teams right now in the tournament. Colombia in action tomorrow. Love it. We're back. Back doing World Cup podcasts.
Feels good. And Landon, give your money to a Mexican-American charity. Put your money where your mouth is, pal, if you really mean it.
Take you later, fun boy.
See you later, man.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast. We'll be right back.